The Tom Woods Show, episode 2304.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am delighted to be joined once again by Alex Epstein, author most recently of Fossil Future, which I urge you to read. You think, Woods, I have a lot of books to read. Yeah, you know what? I'm sure they're all wonderful. I want you to put them in a little pile in the corner of your room where they probably are already. And you're going to take Fossil Future and you're going to read that instead, because you are going to be blown away at how good this book is. I'm sorry, but is this a good enough pitch so far, Alex?
Nobody beats you for pitches. You know, I like to put out quotes from people who positively review the book, and yours is still my favorite. And I think you
I appreciate that. Just equaled
your best.
And you run something called the Center for Industrial Progress. I'm doing this from memory.
Yes, that's true. Although our website isn't very updated, the main website I use these days is energytalkingpoints.com.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Energytalkingpoints.com, so that you can have in your brain a distilled version of Alex Epstein's brain, which you can never have, but at least you can have this distilled version. In particular, I want to talk about extreme weather and just some other related issues that might come up. But before we do that, I want you to recount for us what just happened. You were testifying before what exactly?
So it's the Oversight Committee in the House, and it was one of the subcommittees on, I forget the exact name, but it's basically had to do with the economy. And then specifically, it was about President Biden's depletion of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and the implications of that for energy security and our economy.
Okay. So it is maybe not the single sexiest topic you've ever discussed. And yet, I'm sure to your surprise, you were ambushed with smear attacks on you and on your ideas. Can I assume this came as a complete surprise?
It did, although I feel a bit naive now that it came as a surprise, because people might know just briefly, the Washington Post tried a kind of ambush on me in advance of the release of Fossil Future. I woke up one Monday and I have a note from my publicist saying, hey, the Washington Post just sent us this outline of a piece that calls you a racist. Like, you have a day or something to respond.
Yeah.
And the whole basis of it, and this will be relevant because they tried the same thing in these hearings, the whole basis of it was they searched everything I had ever written. And so they found some things I'd written in college that were not racist at all. They were individualist, but specifically they said that Western civilization, because of freedom and individualism, is superior and that it's good for everybody. Namely, that these are universal values, not really Western values. They're universal values that happen to be discovered first in the West. And I was advocating that everyone embrace them instead of, say, having things like slavery and female genital mutilation and things that exist around the world that are really bad. But because the Post and others were out to get me, and because they're collectivists, they tried to portray me as racist instead of, really, it's anti-racist in the proper sense of the term. But because I was able to preempt it on social media, particularly Twitter, and it got mentioned on Joe Rogan and all over the place, they delayed the publication by a week, and then they sanitized it and removed all instances of racism. And it was widely regarded as a big PR victory for me, because I got a lot of positive attention for figuring out how to respond to one of these unjust cancellations. Plus, I got a huge amount of attention for the book, and they were trying to get attention away from the book. They had received the book, and instead of reading the book, they tried to irrationally cancel it in this way. So I kind of thought I was done with that, because I had so decisively defeated this.
And by the way, it's so rare to have that decisive a victory, or any victory at all. That is such a rare thing.
It wasn't in my mind, but I was certainly prepared, as we'll see, for this kind of situation. I mean, in general, I'm very prepared for these kinds of attacks. But going in, I was just so on top of this issue of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, all the counterarguments against me, what they might say, etc. And so I was coming in just so wired to talk about anything anyone would want to talk about. And then there's an opening presentation by Chairman Pat Fallon, and he introduces the issue and makes a lot of points that I generally agree with. And then I'm waiting for, okay, what is a leading member, ranking member Cori Bush going to say? And I wasn't that familiar with her in advance. I know now she's a member of the squad, and maybe I shouldn't have been surprised by what happened. So I thought she would just have some staff-written talking points. making points that I disagreed with, and then I was ready to counter those. But no, instead, she very quickly went into the Republicans brought on this witness who has espoused white supremacist views. And interestingly, then she had posters made. So she had somebody go to Kinko's or whatever and make up these posters in advance. So this was the substance of her opening presentation on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is my statements about Western civilization that she called racist, even though the second statement that she posted explicitly said it wasn't about race. So it's just so stupid and inept and irrelevant. But nevertheless, it's something that had to be countered. And people can see what happened on the web. But basically, Pat Fallon gave me a minute to respond, which I was grateful for. Otherwise, I would have just had to take the first minute of my testimony. And I really just countered that this was totally despicable and that what I said was individualist and that I did not apologize at all. And I think it was very effective. I mean, that certainly made the hearing get a lot more attention than it would have had it just been about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Yes, right. Yes. But most people are not waiting with bated breath for the outcome of a hearing like that. But for you to stand up for yourself again and refuse to apologize, that's just a rare thing, because most people, well, they hem and haw, or they've got some way they're going to explain away what they said. No, I didn't say anything wrong. So why should I apologize? It's so rare to see that. So I'm glad we saw it with you. So congratulations.
I mean, I would have apologized if I had said something wrong, although I would have pointed out, why are you doing, like, what is the point of bringing this up here? Obviously, it's a false ad hominem is what it is, right? So instead of attacking my argument, they're attacking me as a person. And then their attack on me as a person happens to be a falsehood. But even just the use of ad hominem shows they're not serious. And then well, there are some other things later, but the Cori Bush thing was the thing that went viral. I think that tweet has almost 5 million views. I was on Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, other shows. And so I'm glad it brought attention to really my approach to these issues. I know a lot of people, I mean, we sold more copies of Fossil Future than we had, and I mean, since pretty near the beginning of the launch. So I'm glad that good things happened, but I will just say that it's a really devious thing that they're trying to do. And I would just say, unless people are really equipped to handle it, which fortunately I am, it's really bad. And to give you one example, another presenter who was called by the Republicans, really, really smart oil trader, he was just portrayed as a shill, falsely, totally, as a shill of the oil industry. And because these guys control the microphone so well, he wasn't really able to defend himself. I mean, he didn't know exactly what to do. And it's a hard situation when you're in Congress, and they really just take advantage of their platform. So if people watch the whole thing, it might be instructive just to watch how I sort of handle and deal with the fact that they have this advantage. I have a bunch of ways of dealing with that because I know that they're going to play dirty, and I'm not going to allow myself to be mistreated in public by them.
I should make sure and put the relevant clip up on the show notes page so people can, in fact, watch it. So that'll be tomwoods.com/2304. In fact, I'll make a note to myself now of you confronting them. Okay, I live in Florida, so hurricanes matter to me. I'm in central Florida, so I'm probably more or less the safest in terms of water, but I worry about it. So if it were the case that there was a trend toward more intense and more frequent weather events, including hurricanes, it would be of direct relevance to me. Now, you have quite a substantial thread on Twitter taking on this particular question. And it seems as if no matter what the weather event is, it could be indeed that the temperature is rising, but it could be that we're getting a lot of snow, and that also proves that we have climate change. No matter what happens, in some way, it is twisted to serve the present narrative. So tell me a little bit about the real trend in terms of hurricane frequency and intensity now and in the future.
I think it's very important that the primary trend we should be concerned with is hurricane danger, and then more broadly, like extreme weather danger or climate disaster danger, because that's what we really care about, right? We don't really care about, oh, what exactly is happening in the atmosphere and what category is this technically? We ultimately care, hey, how much damage is this doing to us? The reason I focus there is because that brings in the full context, because the full context of anything involving climate or weather is it's always an interaction between our capabilities and then our atmospheric surroundings. And I think we need to be very, very aware of just the hypothetical that as long as we improve our capabilities sufficiently to neutralize climate danger, it matters less and less what happens with our atmospheric surroundings. So what we know for sure is that we are far safer from every form of extreme weather imaginable. And this is reflected in the stat that I've promoted a lot, which is still true, which is that climate-related disaster deaths have decreased 98% over the last 100 years. That includes hurricanes, other forms of storms, floods, et cetera. So what we need to start out with is that extreme weather danger has plummeted. And it's plummeted very, very drastically. If you look at damages, damages tend to be flat or they tend to be down when adjusted for inflation, of course, but also increased wealth. So if you take Florida, yes, there's more damage done in Miami now from a storm than there would be 100 years ago because there's so much more wealth. But if you adjust for that, there's not an increase. So what we have is pretty static stuff in terms of financial damages and then plummeting deaths. So we know that danger is way down, and it's way down in large part because of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels power all the machines that allow us to neutralize climate danger. For example, building sturdy buildings and having storm warning systems in the case of hurricanes, both of those are huge, huge things that make us far, far safer from extreme weather. So I think that's the most important thing is that the danger has plummeted and we can expect our mastery over it to continue to expand as long as we have freedom and technology and crucially more energy. I think that's the context in which we need to look at, okay, what do we have in terms of the atmosphere? Because usually people just jump to the atmosphere, but they ignore mastery. But mastery is clearly the biggest variable, at least at this point. And so what we find with hurricanes is so far, there's not much of a trend in terms of frequency and intensity. And then interestingly, if you look at the predictions of the future, even by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I consider biased in a number of ways, even their projections are pretty mild. They say they expect a decrease in frequency and then an increase between 1 and 10% in intensity. So this is nothing that is worth worrying about a lot, and certainly nothing that's worth gutting our ability to use energy, because energy allows us to make everything better, including to master extreme weather.
You have a remark in this Twitter thread that really struck me about Hurricane Ian, which did do a fair amount of damage. And you were talking about people who speculated on exactly how much more intense Hurricane Ian was because of climate change. And this is, of course, entirely speculative. But you said one thing we can know is that without fossil fuels, Florida would have been a third world place that Ian would have utterly demolished, which is a kind of perspective we rarely get, to put it mildly.
And it's important because the perspective is to rapidly eliminate fossil fuels. You notice how much of a fatalist attitude there is with hurricanes and other kinds of climate events. I mean, there's this idea that, hey, let's improve technology to deal with this. I mean, even with Mars, for God's sake, right? Elon Musk is like, hey, we can colonize Mars. We can terraform Mars. But then he historically has been a catastrophist about, oh no, we can't let it rise 2 degrees on Earth. There's nothing we can do about that. We can solve Mars, but we can't solve a warmer Earth. Fortunately, he's improved on this a bit over the years for reasons I don't fully understand. But with Ian, you would think just logically, hey, let's make ourselves safer from this and let's have a can-do attitude and let's celebrate the fact that we're obviously far safer than we used to be. Instead, it's no. Let's pursue some Florida-specific net zero goal that would totally devastate us. And by the way, we'll do almost nothing globally because other people won't be stupid enough to pursue that goal. So it's really important to think about what was Florida like before in terms of its vulnerability and what would it be like if it rapidly eliminated fossil fuels when we don't have a viable near-term replacement.
I think I might have asked you this before. There's a column that Matt Ridley wrote over in the UK, and he's pretty good on these issues too.
Yeah, definitely.
Where he was saying that, in fact, there might actually be, he said he got into so much trouble for this column, there might actually be an upside to some warming. And I guess my question to you is, unless we're going to believe that up till recently, the world's temperature was absolutely at the optimal level, which would be incredible coincidence. I mean, amazing if we were actually already at the optimal level such that any deviation would be only downside. That just seems to me so implausible that what I wonder is, couldn't it just be the case that if the atmosphere were to warm, become somewhat warmer, that there would be some downsides, but there would also presumably be some upside? Am I just being dumb by thinking that way?
No, I think this is very reasonable. And in Fossil Future, I talk about specifically in chapter 7 and 8 about just how to think about this. And you know, the way I think about all the climate stuff is there are three variables you have to consider when you're thinking about our climate impacts using fossil fuels. And so one is the benefit of fossil fuels. You need to just think about the overall benefits of fossil fuels. Two, which I've already focused on, is what are the what I call climate mastery benefits? How do fossil fuels enable us to neutralize climate danger? That's most of our mastery. But we need to factor that in, because if we can make ourselves so capable of neutralizing storms, then it doesn't matter too much, even if the intensity increases, say, 10%. And then the third thing is we need to look at the climate impacts themselves with even-handedness and precision. So even-handedness means look at positives and negatives. And once you start to think about that, it's obvious that there are going to be some positives from the greening that happens because of CO2, but also warming. I mean, we live in a world where far more people die of cold than of heat. And if you look at the warming models and the history, warming tends to occur more in colder places during colder seasons and at colder times of day. So what you can expect with warming going forward, and this is what every warming model I've ever seen says, is that in terms of heat and cold-related deaths, you're going to save more people from cold-related deaths than you're going to cause by heat-related deaths for the foreseeable future. And yet the most notable thing here is that people don't even consider the positives. And I think this goes to philosophy and what I call the anti-impact philosophy or the anti-impact framework, which just believes that all human impact on nature is intrinsically immoral. So we just shouldn't do it. It's just wrong. And then inevitably self-destructive, nature is going to punish us. So people just aren't open to the possibility of, wait, maybe this could be a welcome byproduct in some ways, let alone, of course, the negatives. We also have a huge ability to master. So overall, fossil fuels are an incredibly good deal.
I want to ask you about something that I think was just a fleeting issue, but it came up a couple months ago, the gas stoves are dangerous thing. And you never know. It seems like that's died down. I haven't heard much about it. But it just goes to show how we're constantly being thrown off balance by wild, crazy proposals coming out of nowhere that we then have to go on the defensive and say, no, I want my gas stove. So what was the real truth of that?
A couple of things just as background there. One is, just so people know, so you know that I what is the expression? I don't know if it's drink your own Kool-Aid, but maybe that's the wrong expression. But I use my own stuff. So when you ask me about something, I immediately just type it into energytalkingpoints.com to make sure I'm reminded of the best points. So I just typed in gas stoves because I have a lot of it in my head, but a lot of the documentation is there. So that's just an endorsement for people. Check out energytalkingpoints.com and use the search function to search anything. The other thing I would say before we get into gas stoves is I want to pause on the idea of they keep coming up with things and we're reacting. There's this phenomenon I talk about at the end of Fossil Future in Chapter 11 called arguing to 100 versus arguing to zero. And arguing to 100 basically means that your side sets the goal and then proposes positive policies to get there. So the other side will say, hey, we need net zero and we need a Green New Deal or Build Back Better or Inflation Reduction Act to get there. That's like arguing to 100. And then arguing to zero is just reacting to that. So saying, no, wait a second, like Green New Deal's bad or this gas stove's bad. And you just try to shoot them down and say, oh, no, your policies aren't practical. And my view is, no, we need to challenge the goal. We need to challenge this goal of net zero, eliminating emissions. Our goal should be advancing human flourishing around the world. And then emissions are at most a part of that. And then we should advance positive policies like decriminalizing nuclear and liberating domestic development, et cetera. Okay, so that's, I think this is very important in terms of the framing. Now, in terms of gas stoves, I also hope that people check out what I have on this, in particular your audience, because it's a pro-liberty audience. I think the way that I deal with it in these talking points is important, because I think you always need to integrate the morality of freedom with the practical details. So just to give you the overall thing, I'll just read it. Instead of informing us with accurate science about gas stoves so we can make better decisions, anti-fossil fuel activists are distorting science to justify forcing their anti-gas agenda on us. And so the basic genesis of this is there's this carefully orchestrated campaign where the lead authors and anti-fossil fuel activists claim that gas stoves cause 12.7% of child asthma. And I think there are two dimensions here. One is this claim is BS, but then the other is this whole approach of we're going to use some scientific identification to take away your freedom is wrong. And I think the basic thing is we should be on the premise of, well, families have the right to incorporate any real science as they judge best. So if you can show a family, hey, there's some danger with using this in a certain form, then they can decide, hey, do I want a different kind of stove? Do I want to ventilate better, et cetera? But instead, what's happening is they're trying to force it on us. And they're trying to dictate to the family, hey, here's what you should do, regardless of what you think about it, regardless of what your considerations are, regardless of whether there's any actual evidence for this. That's one of the important points. And then, yes, this 12.7% claim was just total nonsense. We don't really know what causes asthma at all. So asthma rates have gone up as pollution has gone down in many places. So it's just not at all clear what goes on with asthma. Asthma's, it's not like this exact thing in your system that can be perfectly found. It's not like a molecule in your system that you can identify. So anyone who's making precise claims with a decimal point about asthma, you know that they're fraud. So basically, this is kind of a pseudoscientific thing that should have been offered to America's families. And I think the most anyone should have done about it is use more ventilation if they weren't already.
Well, maybe if there was one thing more ridiculous than the gas stove scare, it's this thing, which I assume is not going to go anywhere. But this idea of climate reparations from the developed world to the developing world, where is this idea coming from?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting idea. And also just once again, energytalkingpoints.com, just search climate reparations and you can find a lot of stuff there.
That's good. On it. Of course.
So yeah, the climate reparations thing, I mean, it's one of these things. It seems like a reductio ad absurdum of the mainstream view, but often these reductio ad absurdum views start to become prominent. I think Ayn Rand had a quote, something like, yesterday's uncontested absurdities are today's accepted slogans, something very close to that. This has that quality to it where it's, hey, if you concede that in general, the use of fossil fuels is overwhelmingly negative and causes climate catastrophe, and then you also recognize that most of the emissions involved come from wealthy places, and then you recognize that the people least able to deal with climate period or any negative climate change are poorer people, then it kind of makes sense to do that. But the thing that's wrong with this is the benefits of fossil fuels are so overwhelmingly greater than the negative side effects, including in climate. That's why we have such a decline in climate danger. And then the benefits have been huge as well to the poorer parts of the world. You look at rising standards of living in the poorer parts of the world. You look at the improvements in medical care, the lack of death from starvation, the lack of death from drought, all of these different things. These have been made possible by fossil fuel use largely in the wealthy world. And you know, the rate of climate disaster death is way lower. So it's just, it's the same basic fallacies going on, but it's in a sense more plausible than the conventional narrative. And what's particularly tragic about it, well, it's incredibly unjust, which that's one thing, but then it's particularly tragic because in practice, it's another means of keeping the poor world poor. Because in practice, what climate reparations means is the wealthy world says, hey, we'll give you dictator, say in Africa, we'll give you a bunch of money in climate reparations to assuage our guilt in exchange for you promising not to let your people use a lot of fossil fuel. But that's what they need. That's what they need is they need to use more fossil fuel to develop. And then also you're keeping these dictators in power, which is bad. So it's really harming the people that it claims to be concerned about by giving their dictators usually some money in exchange for them basically refusing to develop in the same way that everyone else has developed.
Yeah. If you were to look at the condition of many of these countries, your first thought would not be, we really got to fight climate change. That thought would never even enter your mind.
And it doesn't enter most of their minds, the citizens.
That's exactly right. Yeah, they're not thinking this way. So it's funny that very often when it comes to development aid, the policies that are being advocated are policies that rich Westerners come up with, either because of guilt feelings or whatever it is, they tend to come up with policies and suggestions that the people on the ground would not have thought of and wouldn't necessarily want. And have terrible track records. But the track record of Western development aid in the developing world is too depressing to get into. Right now, have you noticed any kind of crack in the facade when it comes to the alleged consensus about climate change and the need for action and so on and so forth, or not?
I think so. I think there are two big variables. So one is, we have had this global energy crisis that's really woken people up to things that really matter. You mentioned in the poor world, they're not thinking about climate change all the time, but that's moved to the wealthy world. So you see Europe, right? Europe having like this winter, they are terrified of winter. And they took a lot of precautions to make it better than it would otherwise be, but they still got, I mean, paid huge amounts of money for natural gas. which had been artificially suppressed by the global anti-fossil fuel movement. So people are suffering massively because of this movement, and they're dealing with real dangers, including the real danger of cold. That's what terrorized Europe. I mean, I think of it like Europe should not be that concerned with cold in 2023, and yet they are. Like, they're afraid of winter. They were, like, it's Game of Thrones. So you just see the regression. So it really wakes people up to, wait, maybe there's a problem with this anti-fossil fuel movement. Maybe at least they're moving too fast. So I think you have that. And then also, I think there's a small group of us, but it's a growing group, who have really made this case that you really need to think about the benefits of fossil fuels if you're thinking about any negative side effects. And then you need to be even-handed, I mentioned before, but also precise when you're thinking about the side effects. So you can't just say, oh, Al Gore said sea levels are going to rise 20 feet in a few decades. That must be true. You actually have to look at what the projections are, and they're, okay, so far we're at about 1 foot a century, which is way slower than our ancestors. And then the extreme projections are 3 feet a century, which is still slower than a lot of our ancestors. Like, once you start looking at the benefits, and then you weigh those and you weigh them carefully against the side effects, also looked at carefully, you just have a much different position. I talk about this quite a bit at the end of Fossil Future. It's one of the reasons I created energytalkingpoints.com. It's just to give everyone the best arguments on every issue. Now, my focus in the last 2 years has been very political in terms of, I educate a lot behind the scenes and work with a lot of leading elected officials. I think their messaging has improved. Still has a long way to go, but you see there's a lot more confident support of fossil fuels than there was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, I remember when I was writing Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, that was kind of considered crazy. And now when they hear Moral Case for Fossil Fuels or Fossil Future, people are more open to it. And also, just FYI, I actually got OpenAI. I got OpenAI to fix ChatGPT, so it'll actually now make cases for fossil fuels.
Oh, now that is a nice advance. That's good to hear. One small thing before I let you go. My friend Walter Block refuses to use the expression that I've used in this episode, the developing world, because he says it's not accurate. A lot of these countries are stagnating. They're not developing. And I noticed that you use the expression the poor world. Is that on purpose?
Yeah, but it's a good point. So we always have to be careful about terminology. And so anytime the mainstream is using terminology, I should be even more questioning of it. But yeah, I think there is such a thing probably as the developing world. I mean, China, I would think of as the developing world, and India, I would think of as developing. But yeah, I think poor is more accurate. There's also kind of underdeveloped. These kind of are all relative terms, because billions of people today are rich by 200 years ago standards. And hopefully 200 years from now, we'll all be seen as poor by their standards. But yeah, I think wealthy world, poor world is a little bit more stark, and developing is a little bit too optimistic given today's policies.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I was just wondering what you thought about that. So we're going to urge people to do a couple of things. EnergyTalkingPoints.com, you're going to love. And also, of course, you want to be reading Fossil Future. Now, I'm going to link to both of these at tomwoods.com/2304. But Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. So both of these things will be available on the show notes page. Again, tomwoods.com/2304. Alex Epstein, go forth and continue your good work. Thanks so much.
Well, and thanks for helping me promote these ideas for many years. I do think they're making a lot of impact. And I do get a lot of people telling me, I learned about you on the Tom Woods Show.
Yeah. Some of my favorite words in the English language. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.